Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are getting into the surprisingly contentious and fiercely competitive world of British academic painting.
That's a great story. It's really about how one single institution, the Royal Academy of Arts, basically dictated British taste for over a century.
Right. It created a whole art market.
Yeah.
And then, you know, slowly but surely found its authority just stripped away by the very artist it was trying to control.
Exactly.
And when you talk about academic painting in Britain, the definition is almost circular. It was just art that was acceptable to the Royal Academy.
And that standard of acceptable was pretty much defined by its first president, Sir Joshua Reynolds, in his really influential lecture series, The Discourses.
So this deep dive is kind of a study in institutional gatekeeping.
It is. The Royal Academy, or the RA, founded in 1768, didn't just promote art. It imposed standards, it dictated what was fine art, and it controlled who got a reputation.
And it ran the only real marketplace.
The only viable one, yeah. It created the entire infrastructure. So our mission today is to track the life cycle of that, well, that absolute power.
And see how artists use their own canvases to fight back.
And to redefine what serious art really meant.
Okay, let's unpack this. But to even understand the RA, we have to start by looking abroad, right? Because Britain was actually a latecomer.
A huge latecomer. The intellectual framework for this started centuries earlier. The very first academy was in Florence, Italy, founded way back in 1563.
Wow, 1563.
And right there, at its foundation, it set up the core ideological battle that would, I mean, it would dominate art debates for the next 300 years.
And that was?
The battle between Disegno and Colorido.
Okay, tell us more about that distinction. It sounds a bit like theory versus practice.
That's a perfect way to put it. Disegno meant design, line, drawing. The thoughtful, intellectual planning of a piece. It's the concept.
The blueprint.
The blueprint.
Yeah.
Whereas Colorido was color, emotion, the actual, you know, application of paint, the spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
And for the academies, this was the difference between a philosophical pursuit and just manual labor.
So to be a serious artist, you had to be on the side of Disegno.
You had to prioritize it. Absolutely.
That bias against the, well, the manual side of things is fascinating. And this is where we find Artemisia Gentileschi, the Italian Baroque painter.
Right. In 1616, she becomes the first woman ever admitted to that Florence Academy.
And her work seems to just fundamentally challenge that idea.
It does. Her self-portrait as the allegory of painting from the 1630s is so profound because it shows her working. She's disheveled. She's got paint on her.
She's getting her hands dirty.
Literally. She's refusing to separate the artist from the physical work. She's arguing that the skill, the process, is just as vital as the concept.
And when you think about her personal story, the horrific rape trial she went through, where she was tortured with thumbscrews to verify her testimony, her insistence on her professional legitimacy, on the physical act of creating, it feels like this incredible act of defiance.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Her life just shows the profound cost of fighting for respect in that kind of rigid, male-dominated world.
Okay, so Italy sets up the philosophy. Where does the institutional model come from?
That comes from France. The French Academy, founded earlier in 1648, was all about glorifying Louis XIV and pushing a strict royal style.
So why was Britain so far behind, waiting all the way until 1768?
The key difference was the government. The British government just never saw art as, you know, an official tool for propaganda. They didn't subsidize it.
So there was no state funding?
None. The Royal Academy only succeeded because it was entirely self-financing.
Yeah.
George III agreed to the whole plan, but only if the admission charge to the annual show covered all the costs.
No cost to the crown, only prestige. And so the RA begins in 1768 with 34 founders, people like Reynolds, Thomas Gainsborough.
And crucially, two women, Angelica Kaufman and Mary Moser.
And that founding gave the RA just immense power.
Oh, total control. It dictated training in its schools. It controlled who became a member of the 40 academicians. And most importantly, it controlled the market through that huge annual exhibition.
So for any ambitious artist,
the RA was the only game in town.
And that exhibition became a huge social event in London. It moved around a bit, didn't it?
It did. From Pall Mall to Somerset House. And then finally it landed at Burlington House in Piccadilly, where it still is today.
And the social status of that show was huge.
Astonishing. It wasn't just about art. It was about being seen. By 1780, something like 60,000 people were attending.
Wow.
But that popularity led to these really competitive brutal hanging practices. Paintings were hung, I mean, literally frame to frame, floor to ceiling.
And your location was everything. The best spot was on the line, right? Eye level.
Exactly. But if you were unlucky, you were skied stuck up in the rafters where no one could properly see your work.
Which directly affected how people painted.
It did. Think about John Constable. He started making his famous six-footers, these enormous paintings, specifically because they were too big to be ignored or skied.
The size was a tactic.
A direct tactical response to the system. It's also why Thomas Gainsborough, one of the founders, actually broke with the RA in 1784 after his portraits of the royal family were skied.
He was insulted.
Deeply. And of course, this whole social scene was immediately satirized. There's a famous print by Thomas Rowlandson.
The exhibition staircase.
That's the one from 1811. It mocks the steep staircase at Somerset House, but it also suggests the male spectators were a lot more interested in the living flesh than in the painted nudes on the walls.
It was a place for social commentary, not just art.
Right. And speaking of which, here's where it gets really interesting. How did the founders show this intellectual seriousness they were so obsessed with?
You mean how did they sell it to the public?
Exactly. We see it perfectly in Johann Zoffany's group portrait, the Portraits of the Academicians.
Oh, yeah, from 1771?
All the RAs are gathered. They're discussing a nude model. They're surrounded by classical statues. The whole image is designed to scream intellectual rigor. It's about disegno, not messy, manual work.
Okay, but hold on. Zoffany, the painter who captured the height of all this academic decorum, isn't he also known as the first and last royal academician to have become a cannibal?
He is. That's the one. After being shipwrecked on his way back from India.
That is just an incredible detail.
It's stunning, isn't it? The gap between the rigid, high-minded image they projected and the wild realities of their lives, it kind of undermines the whole project of control.
So back to that project of control. The whole system was written down, right? In Reynolds' 15 Discourses.
That was the rule book. And it endorsed the very strict French hierarchy of genres.
Okay, so what was at the top of the pyramid?
Number one, the highest rank, was history painting. This meant a classical or a Bible story with a clear moral point. The goal was to show the universal essence of things.
Very intellectual. And number two?
Portraiture. This was hugely popular. You know, the one that actually paid the bills. By 1817, it was half the show. The most prestigious was the full-length swagger portrait.
So we've got high-minded moralism, and then we've got the art that rich people actually wanted to buy.
That's a good way to put it. History painting was the ideal. Portraiture was the reality.
Okay, so what came next?
Number three was genre, or subject painting. A humorous story, a human interest scene, usually with a pretty simple moral lesson. It was painting that acted like a short story.
And below that, it gets a bit looked down upon.
Oh, yeah. This is where the marginalization really kicks in. Fourth was landscape. That was seen as too specific, not universal enough.
Unless it had some classical ruins in it.
Right. Then it could be a history landscape. Then fifth, animal painting. And at the very, very bottom.
Let me guess. Still life.
Still life. Considered suitable for lady artists as a hobby. Purely decorative, no intellectual substance at all.
So you establish this incredibly rigid structure with all its rules and its judgments. And you're basically just starting a countdown to rebellion.
Of course. Great artists rarely follow the rules for long.
So where did the cracks first appear?
They appeared right at the top. In history painting, Benjamin West's The Death of General Wolfe in 1770 caused an absolute scandal.
Because he painted the figures in their real clothes, not in classical togas.
Exactly. Reynolds and even King George III felt it compromised the, quote, timeless dignity of the genre.
It seems like such a simple choice, but it was revolutionary. It pulls history out of the ancient past and slams it into the present.
It does. And West defended it. He argued that the same truth that guides the pen of the historian should govern the pencil of the artist. It was a radical idea.
And then there was the scandal of the nude.
William Eddy, an RA member, but he was pretty much the only one painting the female nude in the early Victorian period. He thought it was the highest form of beauty.
And the critics hated it.
They were vicious. The London Examiner attacked his lascivious mind. Critics said things like, "No decent family can hang such sights on their walls."
So how did he defend himself?
With morality. He used the biblical line, "To the pure in heart, all things are pure," claiming his nudes were innocent and moral. It just shows how everything had to be framed in moral terms.
You see social codes being tested everywhere, even in portraiture?
Even by Reynolds himself. His portrait of the actress Mrs. Abington depicts a woman from the demi-monde, you know, women who flouted polite society.
And her gesture with her thumb to her lips?
It was a classical sign for silence. But to people at the time, it looked flirtatious, unrefined. It was a proper portrait, but with this little injection of theatrical impropriety.
The biggest challenge, though, seems to come from social realism.
Yes. In genre painting, you have someone like Abraham Solomon, whose painting, Waiting for the Verdict, was a huge commercial hit. It was sentimental, easy to understand.
But you compare that to something like George Frederick Watts's Found Drowned.
Which is just shocking for the time. It shows a fallen woman who has committed suicide under Waterloo Bridge. It was presenting these brutal truths about poverty and injustice.
And the Victorian public just wasn't ready for that.
Not at all. They wanted moral lessons, not a sociology lecture. Watts actually hid the painting for 30 years.
Yeah.
He knew it wouldn't be tolerated.
So the resistance is there, but the RA's monopoly is still pretty absolute.
For about a century, yes. But then alternatives start to pop up. Early on, you get specialized groups like the Royal Society of Painters in watercolors, who felt their medium wasn't respected by the RA.
But the real game changer was the Grosmeur Gallery in 1877.
That was the seismic shift. It was the first substantial alternative venue, and it didn't just show different art.
It showed it differently.
Completely differently. No more crowded floor-to-ceiling mess.
Mm-hmm.
The Grosmeur hung paintings with space around them. It was designed for quiet, discerning viewing, not for a high society party.
A gallery for people who actually cared about the art, not who was standing next to them.
Precisely. And the figurehead for this new era was James Abbott McNeill Whistler.
Whose work the RA had already rejected.
Right. His painting Symphony in White, number one. And Whistler provided the new philosophy that would finally kill the academic style. Art for art's sake.
He rejected the need for a story, for a moral.
Entirely. He titled his works Symphony or Nocturne. He was telling you that the painting was first and foremost an arrangement of line, form, and color. He was divorcing art from its subject.
He was prioritizing colorido, the mood, the feeling over diseño, and its moral purpose.
And this modern style, plus the new gallery, leads directly to that famous trial, Whistler versus Ruskin in 1878.
The dramatic climax.
It really was. Whistler sued the era's most powerful critic, John Ruskin, for libel after Ruskin said Whistler was asking 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint in the public's face.
The core of the argument was about the value of art itself.
It was about spontaneity versus academic labor, expression versus moral purpose.
And the outcome was symbolic.
Whistler won the case, technically. But he was only awarded a farthing, the smallest coin possible, and the court costs completely bankrupted him.
But even though it was a personal disaster for him,
the trial signaled the beginning of the end for the RA's total power. Whistler had forced a public debate about what made art valuable. The old academic rules were finally giving way to personal expression.
Which brings us to the end of our deep dive. We've traced this ironclad hierarchy from Reynolds, watched artists like West challenge it from within, and then saw it shatter under modernists like Whistler.
The RA's reign really shows you that institutions don't just define what we see, but how we see it. Its decline was this massive shift of authority from the institution back to the individual artist.
So after going through centuries of this fight over what makes a painting serious, what's the takeaway for us today?
I think you should consider that very first distinction again. That battle between diseño, the intellectual plan, and colorido, the emotional impact. Even today, when you look at a piece of contemporary art, what do you find yourself valuing more? Is it the artist's concept, their technical skill, the clever idea behind it? Or is it the immediate emotional hit, the raw color, the expression?
Which side of that 16th century Italian argument do you stand on?
Exactly. When you're standing in a gallery, which side do you land on?
That is a fascinating question to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.